Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. But we're not going to take either of those. We'll talk about some other Frost poems this time. Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, the podcast where discussion makes up half your final grade. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me this time is guest host Eric Stadnick.
Hi! That's me.
Hi. Now, Eric was introduced to me on Twitter, actually. Do you want to tell everyone about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a podcaster. I do a couple Doctor Who podcasts and a podcast about horror movies. But a friend of mine was recently on the show. Erica Ensign came on to discuss The Old Man and the Sea. And I hadn't actually heard about the Sophomore Lit podcast until then, even though John and I are both in a rather active Facebook group through his brother's podcast, but I had somehow missed the talking about it. And so I was very excited to find out about it and immediately said, "Hey, John, have me on the show." And you very quickly said, "Sure." And so here we are.
I was happy to have you on because you're one of the few people who has agreed to talk about poetry. And I've been keen on doing a poetry episode for some time now. Poetry, of course, made up a lot of our high school lit classes, but as I've discovered, most people don't have very fond memories of their poetry in high school. What do you remember of poetry in high school?
I loved it because it was, it's not that there are no wrong answers, but that there are so many right answers that you, that unless you were just sort of terrified at the very prospect, which I think some people just get terrified of the prospect, as long as you can like cite anything in the poem at all to support what you're thinking, you're fine. My favorite example of this is we were doing a Frost poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, and one girl, very bright girl in the class, cited a few elements in the poem to indicate that she thought the poem might be about Santa Claus. And the teacher was just sort of like, "Yeah, I guess you could think that." And so, I mean, it's clearly not a poem about Santa Claus, but, you know, there's enough stuff there that you could think about Santa Claus, so why not?
I loved poetry too, but I do recall it being a kind of a painful class whenever we would do poetry. I remember we did a segment on the Romantic poets on Wordsworth, and we did it on Kubla Khan,
Coleridge,
right? Wordsworth and Coleridge, who of course published together, and the reading aloud section of that was terrifying. The kids just had nothing, no idea what to do. Reading aloud was always a dicey proposition in high school, but whenever you had to read aloud from poetry or from Shakespeare, it just became an exercise in pulling teeth. The other thing that I would say is I get the feeling that for students like you and me who enjoyed it, poetry seemed to be about possibilities of interpretation and the imaginative ways of entering into it. But I think for a lot of people, strangely enough, poetry is a kind of a frightening prospect because they see it as, for some reason, I think people feel a little bit more afraid about being wrong about poetry. When they're asked questions about poetry, they feel put on the spot as though they're being asked to display some sort of artistic bona fides or something.
I think that's right. I think people have the same reaction to poetry they do about art or like painting, for example, where they see something and they don't think it's enough to just say, "That's very beautiful. I like that." They think they then have to come up with some sort of fancy reason and analyze it. And actually, no. Poetry, its primary goal is to make you maybe feel something or think about something or enjoy just the sound of words. And if it does that for you, and that's where it ends for you, that's fine. You know, if you want to go then on do a 20-page essay about, you know, what T.S. Eliot's going on about in the wasteland, that's up to you. But like, just approach it the same way you would any other thing written down and then say whether you like it or not. And that's all you need to do. But I think you're right. People do feel as if they need to somehow, it's not enough to have a reaction to it. They have to have a justification and an intellectual response, which is not really necessary.
Well, I do think that the intellectual response, I think that's a good point you make there, because I think that in high school especially, the teachers quite often would jump very quickly to the symbolism of a poem as the key to understanding it. And that's not necessarily the way that poetics work. Mm-hmm. So either you get hand-fed these symbols, or you get taught some very dry things about poetics. You get taught what a sonnet is. You get taught what a VNL is. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's very helpful as a way for a young person especially to approach this.
Yeah, I think that's entirely right. I think people get very hung up on teaching the mechanics of poetry and the sort of trying to break it down. And they sort of forget to just stop after you read a poem and say, did you like that? Do you like the way the words sound together? Or sort of, did it make you think of anything? And they immediately go start doing like, well, let's analyze the meter. And you start trying to vivisect the unicorn before you even looked at the unicorn. Like, poetry, when it works, is kind of, it's a lot like music. It's like, you can look at the parts, but the reason it works is kind of fundamentally mysterious. And there can be very little separating good poetry from great poetry, and even kind of sometimes even less separating good poetry from bad poetry.
Long after my high school career, when I was in graduate school, and I did for a short time or study fiction writing, but I also had to teach fiction writing and poetry writing, one of my professors said something that I always remember. It was a professor named Askold Melnichek, who's a poet himself. And he said that poetry's job is to slow us down. Mm. He said that the trouble is that people try to approach poetry as though it were some sort of alternative way of saying something, rather than that it's a way of confusing ourselves and complicating the language so that we stop and take notice of what we're talking about. You know, as the years have gone by, sometimes I thought that's the greatest thing I've ever heard. Sometimes I thought it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. It depends upon my mood, but I thought I'd toss that out there.
I think there's a lot of merit to that. And, you know, if Shakespeare, for example, wanted to just write a poem, or wanted to just write, I think you're very pretty, he could have done that. But sometimes what you're trying to express is more complicated than that and more nuanced. And poetry, because it is about concision and precision of word choice and word order and things, it does, you can't usually just read it very cleanly. There's always a little bit of a stutter or why is it done that way that kind of forces you to sort of engage with it more slowly than you would prose. And by doing so, you're forced to sort of just briefly, if for no other, you know, if for nothing longer than 30 seconds, to at least briefly sort of engage with the ideas or the words or even to the language being presented.
Well, I'm afraid that we're already guilty of over-intellectualizing. So let's move to our poems. I've chosen this time two poets who wrote at pretty much the same time. Eric, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry.
Okay. Just the sound completely disappeared. Mm. Don't worry. I'll edit all this out. I've chosen this time two poems, two poets who published at the same time, Robert Frost and Carl Sandburg. And the poems that we're going to look at, while they were all taught to me in high school, were also poems that were published in the same year, in 1914. And so I thought that was a kind of an interesting thing to choose. Both Frost and Sandburg have been given the label of regionalist poets, meaning that they are closely associated with their points of origin. Frost with New England, and Sandburg with Chicago. And, you know, I could go into a lot of background on the authors, as I often do in these podcasts, but this time I'm going to do things a little differently. This time we're going to listen to the poems, and then we're going to just discuss them. So our first poem is Robert Frost's Mending Wall, which came from his collection North of Boston, published first in Britain and then later in the United States in 1914.
Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun, and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding, to please the yelping dogs. The gaps, I mean. No one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top, in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only, and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well. He says again, good fences make good neighbors.
I think the first thing I just want to, about Mending Wall that I really enjoy is the sort of, it's from the beginning, it seems to be, it's a poem kind of about two-sidedness and duality, like the very idea of there being a wall, and then this idea on that the narrator keeps talking about, you know, his side of my neighbor on the other hill, his side of the wall, my side of the wall, and they're kind of always walking, and the idea that walls separate one thing from another, and that is kind of their purpose. And even the poem itself sort of presents two arguments about whether or not walls are good or bad things in and of themselves. You know, he begins very strongly by saying something there is that doesn't love a wall, which seems to be implying that sort of nature itself is sort of revolting against the idea. But then the man, his neighbor, says good fences make good neighbors, which is talking not about nature itself, but more about sort of human interaction. And so you have those two sides as well, nature versus man. And it's the thing I love about Frost and why he's so easy to read and why I think he's still tremendously popular and easy to teach is he just writes. You know, he's only like 20 years after like High Victoriana is going on and poetry is almost unintelligible at times. And he just writes so clearly and crisply and simply yet perfectly that it just, you read it in a minute and a half or 2 minutes and you think, wow, that's really nice. That's good.
Yeah. It's true. When you hear this read aloud, it really just sounds like the way people talk. But the peculiar thing is, if you go back and look at this, it's perfect iambic pentameter, this whole poem, but it is written like conversational English. It's the sort of thing that if you heard it aloud, I don't think anyone would stop to think about the poetics of it at all. But Frost can be quite the formalist when he wants to. And that kind of play between the sort of folksiness of the language, the plain speak, particularly the plain New England speak, mm-hmm. and sort of the icy cold deliberation that Frost brings to his poetry is what fascinates me. You know, I live in Boston, and you can't go more than, you know, a half mile in any direction without running into one of these New England walls, which are famously just stacked rocks. It's a very peculiar thing that locally they don't use mortar. They just put up these rocks and they stack them. And it is a funny kind of New England tradition, and they do fall over as one might imagine.
Yeah.
So he's found something in his environment that to write about. And as you say, it is about duality. It is about being on one side or the other. And one of the things that fascinates me as I listen to it is how Frost is a quick thinker. He's wry. He's sarcastic. He's playful. He's finding all these little things to talk about. He's talking about elves coming down the wall. He's talking about the hunters and rabbits. And his neighbor is completely taciturn and completely unknowable. And all he wants to do is repeat the same thing again and again. Good finches make good neighbors. Mm-hmm. And he can't. And I think one of the things that's fascinating to me is how respectful Frost is of that relationship. There's the sense that Frost is this quick-minded guy who's looking for connection, and his neighbor is having none of it.
Which is the traditional New England, and especially Frost spent a lot of time in Vermont, which is even more New England than New England a lot of times. And that sort of New England taciturn, you know, Yankee sort of quietness is very much on display in the neighbor saying good fences make good neighbors, and then just repeating good fences make good neighbors. But Frost, as you say, gets a slight little jab. His neighbor is so fond of having thought of what his father said that he repeats it. He's like, oh yeah, I thought of that thing. That was funny. I'll say that again. To the point where Frost is so kind of like the wall is not only physical, it's sort of this wall between these two men, and he's trying to think of any way to maybe get through it. And he goes to the absurd of, I could say elves to him, which is just fun. Not a phrase you expect to find in poetry a lot. I could say elves to him. And it's just this wonderful sort of him trying to find, is there a way I can sort of bridge this gap? But the neighbor is content to just keep rebuilding it every spring.
Well, I love that the next line after that is, I'd rather he said it for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, again, it's that longing for connection, but it's not going to happen. And there is this kind of, on the other hand, there is a kind of a connection going on here, because he talks about how it's a day that they've met together and they're going along, and he says it's a game that they're playing between the two of them, that he'll pick up the rocks on his side and his neighbor will pick up the rocks on his side. And there is something kind of touching and lovely about these two men coming together and doing this absurd thing. Maybe this is the only way that they're going to meet. This is the only thing that they're ever going to hold in common.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the wall is built fundamentally by both of them. The wall is essentially, it's their thing. They have made this between the two of them, although more likely they inherited it, but they maintain this. It's not one or the other building the wall. They walk down, and it's like a game, but it's also this communal joint exercise where they're each putting up the rocks that have fallen on their own side. But they also, he views he kind of gets at some of the absurdity of the situation by saying, you know, we have to play the game where we look at the rock and say, no, don't fall over until my back is turned. it's like as long, if you fall over when I'm walked past, I don't care. Just don't fall over when I'm still looking at you.
Do you have any last words you want to say on this poem before we move on to the next one?
It's definitely one I love, and it's one I definitely was taught in high school. It's not my favorite of his, because I think it's, I don't want to say it's bad, but it's certainly not bad. It's great, but it's sort of, it doesn't touch me the same way some of his other ones does. It seem a bit lighter in tone and in spirit, which is, you know, when Frost wants to go dark, he goes dark. And I kind of like it when Frost is very dark, and this is sort of medium dark for Frost.
Yeah, no, that's interesting that you say that. When I was looking up what critics said about Frost in preparation for this, I noticed that a lot of modernist poets, and we're thinking about people like Randall Jarrell, who was a huge fan of Frost, people like Ezra Pound and other people really looked to Frost to see something very bleak mm-hmm. and existential. And a lot of people who aren't necessarily great readers of poems, but who are New England fans of Frost said, oh, Frost does a good job of capturing the New England spirit.
Which maybe says something about New England, yes.
It says a lot about New England. Okay, so the second poem we're going to listen to is also from North of Boston, a little later in the book. It's called After Apple Picking.
My long two-pointed ladder sticking through a tree toward heaven still, and there's a barrel that I didn't fill beside it. and there may be two or three apples I didn't pick upon some bough, but I am done with apple picking now. Essence of winter sleep is on the night, the scent of apples. I am drowsing off. I cannot rub the strangeness from my sight I got from looking through a pane of glass I skimmed this morning from the drinking trough and held against the world of hoary grass. It melted, and I let it fall and break, but I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell, and I could tell what form my dreaming was about to take. Magnified apples appear and disappear, stem end and blossom end, and every fleck of russet showing clear. My instep arch not only keeps the ache, it keeps the pressure of a ladder round. I feel the ladder sway as the boughs bend, and I keep hearing from the cellar bend the rumbling sound of load on load of apples coming in, for I have had too much of apple picking. I am overtired of the great harvest I myself desired. There were 10,000,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, lift down, and not let fall. For all that struck the earth, no matter if not bruised or spiked with stubble, went surely to the cider apple heap, as of no worth. One can see what will trouble this sleep of mine, whatever sleep it is. Were he not gone, the woodchuck could say whether it's like his long sleep, as I described its coming on, or just some human sleep.
You know, especially when you hear this poem, you hear the fluidity and the sort of, there's a lot of rhyme, and there's Mending Wall, it's not a rhymed poem, whereas After Apple Picking is rhymed, although it's completely unpredictable rhyme scheme. It's not this lovely little A-B-A, B-A-C-B, it's nothing like that. It seems like you're going to be falling into a pattern, and then he keeps sort of switching it up, and he also keeps playing with the line lengths. So you have this wonderful fluidity, which I think the reading captures nicely. It does flow, but you're never quite sure where you are. It's like you're on an ocean, and you know it's kind of rocking you gently, but you don't know where your ship is going. that general sort of, and it's almost, especially the text of the poem creates a very almost dreamlike state where you're never, what is he actually talking about? Is any of this happening? Is he like all of this happening in that sort of moment where you fall asleep and you remember your day? Is that what's going on? It's really hard, but it is, again, the sound of it and the reading of it, it's just, it's one of my favorite like two or three Frost poems. I adore this poem. I was so happy you picked it. I love After Apple Picking.
It's an amazing poem for the way that it confuses time. Mm-hmm. If we have this part where he talks about in the morning, he skims the ice from the drinking trough and holds it up and what looks through the world. And first of all, there's this kind of a, you know, look through a glass darkly,
exactly,
kind of thing,
yeah,
that's going on here. But then he says, it melted and I let it fall and break, but I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell. And that's so confusing and strange because this is ostensibly a memory of something that happened this morning. But now he's saying he's already on his way to sleep before it falls to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that that's compressing all the time of the day of his picking apples. As you say, this is a brilliant depiction of what it is to fall asleep and to have your mind full of thoughts that you have no control over. I particularly find affecting his discussion of the way that he feels the sway of the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
Because if, you know, again, where are you from, Eric?
I'm from Pennsylvania. So
Pennsylvania. Yes. Have you been apple picking?
I've never been actual apple picking. I've been blackberry picking. That's as close I've ever gotten.
If you ever get up to New England and actually go apple picking, they have these very strange ladders that look sort of like, crutches, because the top is a single rung so that you can kind of stick it in wherever you can find space in the apple tree.
Mm.
And then apple trees themselves have branches that bend and sway as you climb them. And at first it can seem very disorienting if you've never done it before, and it can seem dangerous. It seems as though the tree is going to break under you at any moment. But you get used to it, and part of getting used to apple picking is the feeling of being on an unsteady, bouncing up and down structure. It's sort of like being out in waves where you feel the toss of the water. Mm. And if you've ever been to the beach and then come back to sleep at night and you feel the waves going over you,
yeah,
as you go to sleep, it's exactly the same feeling.
I used to feel that a lot when after long car trips and things, you sort of, your body still feels as if you're moving. And he definitely, it's like his physical body has imprinted upon itself everything he experienced during that day, but also it seems like every day he's ever done apple picking. It's almost this sort of Mrs. Dalloway, sort of like all of a man's life in one moment. And it's all of his life with picking apples and wanting to pick apples. And then what do the apples mean? And that's where you get into the symbolism thing that the high school teachers will go on about. But it's fun to just read the poem and get the feeling he's going for. And it's exactly that moment where you're uncertain about what exactly is going on and what are you remembering and what is your mind sort of creating and when did it all happen, but it's all sort of there at once, omnipresent somehow.
To dip a little into symbolism here, we'll try to stay not too deep in this. One of the favorite readings of this poem is that the apple picking is a metaphor for poetry writing, insofar as there's the discussion of him holding the apples in his hand and holding them gently, and then any that are slightly imperfect have to be thrown away right away, which is true about apple picking, because as everyone knows from the phrase, one bad apple spoils the bunch, it is true that if one apple starts to rot, the other apples around it will rot with it. So you have to be very careful about what you let into your batch. But of course it becomes a metaphor for writing, but it can also become a metaphor for any creative endeavor in which one has to be both loving and attentive and extremely ruthless about what you keep and what you discard. And that's kind of the creative life in general.
The kill your darlings idea, that you have to be tremendously dedicated to making sure that only your best work ever makes it out. And I think that's an entirely valid reading, but the one I always keep going back to is this idea of, you know, the biblical interpretation of, or at least the way people interpret the apple as being the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and that he does talk about the ladder being pointed towards heaven still. And there's this idea of the apple, sort of the knowledge he's gone out and seek and trying to find the perfect things, and but at a certain point you become over full of the apples he was so desirous of. That's why he's done with apple picking now. It's because he's had too many apples, just tens and tens of thousands. There's just no more he can take. And that at a certain point, we continue reaching for these things, but we never get any more. It's just more apples. It's like...
Right. And there is, of course, the final part, which is talking about one can see what will trouble this sleep of mine, whatever sleep it is. And, of course, whenever we hear about sleep in poems, we think about mortality and death. But in this case, it's a very strange and very nuanced discussion, because already we've had this confusion about time and about what is memory and what is reality. And he talks about the woodchuck who is hibernating. Mm-hmm. And he says whether it's like his long sleep, as I describe it's coming on, or just some human sleep. And it is very disquieting and unsettling to me. I mean, it's not so easy. Again, this is where I feel like reading this too symbolically will lead you astray. If you really want to say, oh, sleep equals death in this poem, then it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But if sleep is like death, then it works perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's what one of the things I love about this poem so much is every time you think you're like, well, this is what it means, it kind of slips out of your fingers, because it's very easy to think, oh, the sleep is death and he's approaching his death and he's an old man remembering his life, blah blah blah. But then the end does sort of strongly indicate, no, it's the two options are human sleep, which maybe he means death there, or the sleep of the woodchuck, which is the woodchuck hibernates but comes back in spring. And whether then it's sleep as rest and renewal, and sort of winter is not just the end of fall, it's the segue into spring. Things kind of quiet and then they reemerge. And so it does, it sort of makes you question that sort of very facile initial assessment of sleep is death. It's like, no, sleep is more complicated, and sleep is something. and everything seems to be constantly shifting in this poem, like the man on the ladder, that it's you're never quite certain where you are with it. And so you can keep coming back to it and seeing new things or feeling different things about it and it having it make you sort of, you think of different things. I just want to also call out, I'm from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania originally, which is, which is Groundhog Day. And so I'm always very fond of after apple picking because in a way there's a slight shout out to Punxsutawney Phil after the woodchuck thing.
Well, before we leave this poem behind, I would just like to point out something that occurred to me when I was reading these. It wasn't my plan when I had chosen these two together, but it occurred to me as I was reading these that that while Frost and Sandberg had roughly contiguous careers and were both pretty much equally well celebrated in their lives, they both were multiple winners of the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. They reminded me a lot of two other poets that reading this Frost reminded me an awful lot of reading Emily Dickinson, another great New England poet who wrote a lot about of small domestic imagery that held beneath it a kind of a quiet and extremely ruthless darkness. And on the other hand, Sandberg, I think to me, even more than Frost suggests Dickinson, Sandberg screams Walt Whitman.
Yes,
to me.
He's trying to be a new Whitman, isn't he?
He's trying very hard to be Whitman. And I think that whether or not he succeeds is another thing. But let's listen to Sandberg's famous poem, Chicago, which was actually the first of several poems on the subject of Chicago, published in 1914 in the collection called Chicago Poems.
Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it is true, I have seen the gunman kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head singing so proud to be alive, and coarse and strong and cunning. Flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job, here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness. Bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding. Under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth. Under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs. Laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle. Bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse, and under his ribs the heart of the people. Laughing. Laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth. Half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation.
And we'll do that in here. And, okay, go.
What's interesting about this poem, and actually every Sandberg poem I've read, is, and this is going to sound really mean compared to what we've been saying about Frost, I just get the feeling that Sandberg is much more concerned with just making his poetry sound fun's not the right word, but sort of there's this a bombacity or grandioseness. He's trying to make his poetry sound kind of like American, like the way that all, you know, every time you see, hear in a movie about America, you hear like trumpets and drums. It's like the American music. This feels like he's trying to do American poetry with hog butcher to the world and all this sort of like, isn't America great and we're coming up and we're young and we're powerful, and it's like, okay, that's all fun, that's all great, what else you got? And and in this poem at least, I'm not entirely sure exactly what else he has. It's actually I think it's a better, much better poem to hear than it is to read on paper. it's definitely, I think, one to be sort of heard, acclaimed.
Well, as I said, it reminds me an awful lot of Walt Whitman, and the basic mode of a Whitman poem is the reverie,
yeah.
which is the idea of we're going to go into sort of a visionary waking dream that is supposed to be expansive.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to cover, he's going to enumerate things mm-hmm. here. And that's certainly what you think of when you think of Song of Myself
yes.
or Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Rocking by Whitman. And if you listen to this, you can hear Sandberg's attempt to do this. Now, Whitman was famously connected with New York City and particularly with Brooklyn. Sandberg, who grew up outside of Chicago and worked in Chicago for most of his life, was trying to do a bit of that, of what Whitman had done for New York for Chicago. And there is a kind of a defensiveness, I think, about this poem that's obviously in the poem, you know, about
yeah.
the you know, we're, and I think
you
that's
say we're
very...
this, you say we're this, I say yes we are, but we still hold our heads up high, and we bear the brunt of the world, and we're strong, and we're young, and we're brash.
Well, I think that there is some truth here. If you've ever been to Chicago, there is a kind of a there is a Chicago personality,
yeah.
which is, you know, it's interesting that the comedy troupe from Chicago is called Second City, because it is this sense that Chicagoans have that they are kind of, you know, they may be in second place, but they try harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you that there is a kind of a way that you the thing that always struck me as kind of funny about this poem was that it's sort of like saying, you may say this about Chicago, and you may say this about Chicago, and then you keep kind of waiting for what's the but
yeah.
part of this.
Yeah, because he keeps conceding every point. You may say we have painted women seducing farm boys. Okay, fair enough. You may say we have gunmen shooting people. Okay, yeah, we got that too. But, and then he finally does come with a but, and it is, and the... It's the line I like most is the idea that under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, which at least gives a hint that the poet at least is aware that under the not necessarily under the bravado, but the bravado lacks the sort of self-awareness that eventually you will lose a battle. Eventually a young man becomes an old man. Eventually tragedy and bad things do happen, but there is something to be cherished in that moment when everything is possible and everything is good and you're young and you can't die and you're immortal. And that's sort of that moment that he's talking about, both for America and Chicago, sort of emblematic of America, that this sort of, you know, and it's I think it's important, it's pre-World War I in a way, that it's like we're on the move and nothing's going to stop us and everything's great. But the poet is aware that, yeah, but things will happen eventually. But right now, let's just kind of really love this moment of strength.
Right. Well, the other thing that, just as you say that line now, and as we heard Josh read the poems, I think that what Sandberg does have is he's got that incredible gift for writing that long, rambling, accented line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that he takes from Whitman is these crazy cascading lines, and it's hard to even describe what the poetics of it are, other than to say there are stresses, there are stress beats, and the lines go on as long as they have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a hard thing to do. I think that a lot of people think they could write free verse because they see it as sort of unformed mm-hmm. and easy. But it's not easy to come up with these lines. It certainly is not easy to come up with Whitman. And I don't think it's easy to come up with these lines either.
No.
The reason I think that everyone remembers Hog Butcher for the World, Toolmaker, Stacker Wheat, is that's pretty dramatic writing there, and pretty, it's arresting. And, you know, you can see the line that is traced between Whitman here, Whitman to Sandberg to Allen Ginsberg.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's just like the opening of Howl. I've seen the best minds of a generation howling because they're, you know, that's the exact same sort of like, and you're right. When you talked about the sort of the reverie is sort of expansive. It's listing all these things. It's enumerating and it's sort of going outside. And I guess fundamentally what I like is that Frost is meditative. It's all inward in a strange way. But Sandberg and Whitman and Ginsberg kind of all do much better sort of going outside and doing this sort of bigger, less meditative, more just exuberant sort of mode. Even if the thing they're expressing is sort of exuberant sadness, it's going to be big. And it is a lovely poem, especially the words, like you said. It's not, you look at the word, like the line, hog butcher for the world, toolmaker stalker of wheat, and you think, that's really kind of dumb. But if you try to fiddle with it, and you're like, piler upper of wheat, it's really carefully chosen, really carefully done, and it works beautifully because of that.
Right. Well, I tell you, if people will put up with this poetry thing, I'm going to do an episode soon on Dickinson and Whitman, and we can discuss this, where this tradition comes from in American poetry. But to wrap up here, mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about, again, this whole question of poetry and teaching it in high school. Because one of the things that I think I was thinking of when I started this podcast is there are people like you and me who went on to be, who were probably already great readers when mm-hmm. we were in high school, and who went on to read more and more, and we kind of breezed through our lit classes. And then there was everyone else who was being forced to read this literature because we have this idea that the humanities are good for them. And I always kind of wonder, how do you actually get people like that to approach poetry?
And this is where I sort of completely get very angry at the American educational system, because it refuses to meet those sort of non-readers, which is the vast majority of, especially with poetry. It refuses to sort of meet them where they are, and instead it forces you to do things like read a lot of Edward Arlington Robinson, or, you know, it forces a sophomore in high school to start reading Whitman, and it's like, Whitman's hard! Whitman's really hard to get your hands around what he's doing. And we don't build on what kids know and like. I kind of wish we could figure out how to draw the line from Dr. Seuss to, like, Whitman. But it's like, kids, young kids, love poetry. They love the sonorous of the sound. They love the rhyming. They love the metrical. They love that. They love the sing-songiness. And it's like, build on that, sort of make poetry constantly sort of evolve with the kids, so that by the time the kids become sort of teenagers and adults, they're ready to sort of grapple with the things that are blank verse, that are sort of free verse, that are not so structured, as opposed to doing this sort of historical overview we tend to do. We start with the things that are the most remote. You're reading Spenserian sonnets, or you're reading snippets from, you know, Phyllis Wheatley or some other early American poets, and it's like, they're really far removed from what kids can understand and relate to immediately. And it poetry should be relatable almost immediately. It's not meant to be hard, at least not necessarily. There is always accessible poetry that I wish we were better at sort of bringing kids into poetry that way. It's like, here's this thing that was written. You know, a good example of that is Gwendolyn Brooks' We Real Cool, which sure. sort of, you know, is this wonderful little short, precise, but perfect poem that any sort of kid in high school or even middle school can read and be like, oh, that kind of sounds cool. I like the way it flows. It's very jazzy. It's fun. And then they can start thinking about what she's doing with the meter in the verse, as opposed to, you know, you get to that like senior year and you're like, yeah, I've already done all the hard stuff. This is... kind of do it all backwards. It's very bothersome to me.
Well, I agree with you. Although, on the other hand, I have to say that as someone who reads a lot of poetry, I do love Spenserian sonnets, and I have read John Dryden and T.S. Eliot, yeah. And I don't know how one actually starts to approach T.S. Eliot. You know, I know how I do mm-hmm. after having had X number of years of high school and X number of years of college and then graduate school after that. But I don't know if is T.S. Eliot just a lost cause for people?
T.S. Eliot's a really horrible example in a way because he wanted to be a lost cause for a lot of people. He deliberately made himself difficult so that, but, you know, to pick someone who doesn't mean to be difficult but is, you know, you could have someone like Milton maybe, who is beautiful but very difficult because his style is archaic and hard. But that just means you work up to them. You don't throw people into the deep end in almost any other. You know, in mathematics, you start with the easy things and then build upon that. We kind of don't know how to do that with poetry because of the way we break down literature. You have American 1 year and then British or however it's done. It's generally not sort of just purely easier and then slightly more complicated and slightly more complicated. So that, you know, theoretically, it would be great if a senior year in high school was Eliot and Spencer and Milton and Shakespeare's sonnets and all the things that require a lot more energy to read, and you've come them prepared with a set of tools that you've developed over years of reading poetry and engaging with it, so that when you encounter something like The Wasteland, you're not struggling with the poetry, you're struggling with what Eliot in particular is doing with the poetry, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, would you like to? I'm going to give you the last word here. Is there anything? You just go however you want to. How would you like to end this?
Every time I read Frost, I want to read more Frost. And so, if it's been a while since you've read some Robert Frost, just go and find one you remember liking, because everyone I think has probably one Frost poem at least that they remember liking, and just go and grab it and reread it and sort of sit with it for just a few minutes. Poetry is a great way to take time out of your life to think about something other than what you're immediately doing, and Frost is one of my favorite poets to do that with.
I'd like to thank guest host Eric Stadnick. You can visit Eric on the web at www.ericandhispointlessblog.com. I'd like to give special thanks to Josh Hollis, who not only read the poems but mixed the sound effects. You can visit him online at joshhollis.com. I hope you've enjoyed this episode on poetry. Let me know any more poems that you might want covered on Sophomore Lit by writing me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com or joining the Sophomore Lit Facebook page. Remember, everything will be on the final.